You're listening to Professor David Garland on the Culture of Control. This is Unwelcome Guests, and you're tuned to WEOS Geneva, WXXE Fenner Syracuse, W201CD Ithaca Community Radio, or Free Radio Santa Cruz. We continue with the conclusion of The Culture of Control with NYU Professor of Law and Sociology, David Garland.
Yeah.
Now, following up on this, I just caught a case a few weeks ago out in a rural county about 65 miles west of Vernon County. I'm facing a charge of hearing 15 years in jail for some marijuana that was growing in the neighbor's forest, which they're trying to pin on me. And I've been out here 30 years in that county, and I can see that these so-called drug laws are just a way that these SWAT teams, now, you know, 25 cops busted down my door. It's a way they have of pinpointing people they term undesirable and getting rid of. In my case, there's collusion, conspiracy, and all of that between two county, multiple agencies. And it's just a plain-out-and-out police state, the way they're using these marijuana laws especially.
You know, the marijuana laws in New York aren't enforced in the same kind of ways you're describing. The marijuana laws in the UK have just been suspended and won't be used again. This kind of edge of the drug story is just, it's absurd to criminalize and absurd to, you know, just ruin people's lives by locking them up, but actually spend taxpayers' money locking people up for this kind of thing. And in the book, I characterize the whole war on drugs as the epitome of a denial reaction. You know, I mean, Nancy Reagan's phrase, just say no, is like a way of responding to the facts. Drug use is a very widespread, pleasurable, and, you know, extensive activity that under no circumstances, short of authoritarian regimes, can you imagine extirpating in this kind of way. And yet for 20 years now, that's been a major undertaking by government. Now, it seems to me that the kind of racial concerns you're describing, the kind of connection into crime that's also a connection into race and into poverty that you're describing is, you know, why it's possible to do this. You know, if it were always the, you know, the children of the white liberal upper classes that were being incarcerated here, we wouldn't have the war on drugs today. It's precisely because the most vulnerable groups, minority groups, who in any sense are a problematic population, by and large excluded from the workplace, by and large, you know, a socially difficult category for government, that this is a functionally effective policy from that point of view. But the point I'm making at the beginning is that it didn't come from nowhere. It wasn't as if the government just said, what I think we should do is criminalize this behavior that, you know, African-American youth particularly are involved in, just because we think it would be a good idea. It was responsive to a very real interconnection between drug use and crime and violence that was already, as it were, part of the transformation of security and part of the collective experience of crime at that time. And in other words, I'm trying again with this example, even though it's the most marginal example of real crime, to tie it into real fears and real concerns that people had and to which politicians were responding as well as leading. There's no, I mean, I don't think there's any rationale behind or any rationality behind the case that you're describing. Right at the back then, and then Eric, and then, yep.
I'm interested in this question of whether the trends that you're describing are what the public actually wants. I think I hear you saying that they are.
That's overstating what I'm saying.
Okay.
But, yeah.
Well, there's a lot of, you're probably aware, there's a lot of polling out there that tends to show that if the question is asked differently,
sure,
people
sure
do not want
sure
these outcomes.
Sure.
They don't want, you know, these sort of exploding prison sentences, and it's sort of maybe more a question of how they're asked, how the choice is put to them. So would you, I mean, I was wondering what your take is on how public opinion really fits in here.
Well, I mean, the point I'm making is not that in every case the public gets precisely what the public wants. That's not the claim. Nor is it even the claim that all the consequences of as it were, one's initial response down the road turn out to be desirable and embraced by the public when, you know, when the bill comes round. However, but the claim I'm making is that there's a real popular investment in punitive politics that's not a fabrication of the media and is not a fabrication of politicians. Were it to be the case that these policies wouldn't succeed, these taxes wouldn't get paid for these purposes, it's absolutely the story, and I tell this in some detail in the book, that the way in which, for political purposes, things like victims are invoked and victims' interests are represented turn out to be highly politicised and quite at variance with the expressed views of actual victims when surveyed about what it is that they would like to happen and so on. In other words, that there is inevitably a disjuncture between, as it were, public support, particularly when, or public opinion, particularly when asked in ways that are nuanced and in the face of alternatives, and the kind of public sentiment that gets expressed in vivid and politically effective ways in the media, in the soundbite, immediately after an atrocious crime. And it turns out that the kind of the gearing of legislation today is linked directly into, as it were, these high visibility events and responsive lawmaking, rather than into carefully designed, properly researched opinion polls about what it is that actual victims say that they want when you ask them. Because the latter, you know, you might have read some of these polls, I certainly read a lot of them, but they're not, you know, prominent, visible, they're not the stuff of the political game. And in consequence, they don't count for anything, in the same way that research by, you know, the RAND Corporation or by, you know, the Sentencing Project or anybody else on the long-term costs of imprisonment and the long-term benefits and the comparative costs of community service and so on, that doesn't make it onto the political plateau these days, not because it's not important politically in the sense that money and institutional expenditure and budgets are always important, it's just that it's undoable right now to be soft on crime, and particularly since both parties have defined what being tough on crime looks like. Yeah? So, you know, what people want and what gets said and what gets listened to are three very different things. Eric was next, and then I think you were next. Yeah.
A couple of interconnected issues. You mentioned just briefly in passing neoliberalism and its linkage to this, but didn't actually elaborate that. Mm-hmm. The early 70s were a turning point on lots of issues. It was the end of the post-war boom. It was the sort of collapse of the general consensus on the regulative interventionism of the state, the early form of the fiscal crisis of the state, and the reorganizing of domestic politics, both in the U.S. and, you know, in Britain. All around the project of marketization and deregulation. And then the question is, how does the specific crime policies figure in that? And one view is the only way to get this dismantling of the affirmative state going was to do it on the basis of fear. We've added international fear as the kind of centerpiece of Bush's right-wing agenda. So replacing domestic fear as the driving wedge, the wedge issue in which you can then bring in its wake a package of reforms that people who were afraid, for one reason, would not have bought into. Well, Bush is doing the same thing internationally. Mm-hmm. Most Americans do not want deregulation of the environment. You know, they're against this whole anti-environmental stuff. But the wedge issue is international terrorism and fear around that. So fear plays a pivotal role in the political mobilization, which is motivated, though, politically by the package, not by...
I disagree with that, actually. I certainly think that hostile sentiment between social groups, particularly with respect to groups that are variously described as claimants or dependents or the underclass or criminal classes, that hostility towards these groups played a large part in, as it were, facilitating the shift away from the welfare state project to neoliberalism. But I think that the main thing that permitted, at least in my view, the main thing that permitted the scaling down of welfare and the extension of market forces and the responsabilizing that neoliberalism allows to the individual. The main thing was the effect of 3 decades of relative affluence and full employment on groups, especially middle-class working groups, that had previously been the primary constituency for welfare policies and who ceased to be such. What I mean by that is that the welfare state policies in the UK, the Great Society and the Social Security policies in this country were primarily based on a sense of pooled risk between groups that stretched across different classes. In other words, the reason that there was widespread support for, say, the welfare state in Britain in the 50s and 60s was that everyone experienced in the previous generation the impact of mass unemployment. Everybody experienced the impact of the war. Everyone knew the vulnerability that illness and ill health and unemployment and old age can bring to a family. And the notion of pooling resources, allowing tax to be the basis for generalized national services, made a lot of sense in, as it were, direct actuarial terms to not just the poor, but also to the middle classes. And in fact, the middle classes were the primary beneficiaries of most of the welfare policies in terms of redistributions across the life course, but also redistributions into, you know, who goes to higher education, who gets the benefits of mortgage facilities and subsidies and highways and so on. So that was the relationship of the middle classes to the welfare state up until the 1970s. What I think happens then is that the experience of relative affluence on the part of these groups makes them no longer think they're vulnerable to the insecurities that the welfare state was there to protect. They think, in fact, that the level of individuation and the level of consumption that they've become accustomed to is such that welfare benefits in any way are too meager for them. They'd rather buy into the private market when they can, and they do so for medicine and for education and for housing increasingly. And also they feel that the groups that are still, as it were, the primary beneficiaries, the poor, the minorities, the welfare claimants, are actually undeserving and not like them. And so what you find is the kind of the disengagement from the welfare project of these middle classes that used to be the kind of backbone of them. And in Thatcher's Britain, that's the story about the Essex Dagenham Motor Company workers. Essex Man, they were called in the newspapers at the time. Basically, people who all their lives had voted. People who were skilled workers, but all their lives had voted for the Labour Party and trade unions. Suddenly voting for tax cuts, and suddenly voting for policies that would give them more money in their pocket, even if it meant that they would be, you know, less welfare spending, because they didn't see themselves as being the welfare beneficiaries. Now, is that a story about fear? I think it begins initially to be a story about a certain sense of, you know, experienced, it's not quite invulnerability, but it's a sense of market position as experienced by these groups. Now, it turned out that that was a big mistake. It turned out that the economy was much less secure in the decades after that than they anticipated. They were, as it were, generalizing from an experience that was to be short-term rather than long-term. But I think that that's why it fell apart, and that's what allowed neoliberalism in. And I think that that's what allowed the kind of the vicious anti-welfare policies of Thatcher and Reagan, which was the sense that, look, you're hardworking. Why should your income be taxed to pay for these people who aren't hardworking and are feckless and undeserving, and by the way, they do drugs and they do crime? Now, is that a story about fear? It's a story about, as it were, racialized, criminalized antagonism between groups. But it's also a story of withdrawal of a key group from the sense of the welfare state as risk pooling to the notion of the welfare state as redistribution to the undeserving. That's the story that I tell in the book. And that's the way in which, in a way, the whole neoliberal project makes crime worse and makes people, as it were, more vulnerable to it rather than less. Because, of course, welfare state supports are being withdrawn. And the rather guilty sense that actually the social landscape one's getting is precisely the one we've been voting for the last 3 or 4 elections is part of the kind of the mindset, I think, of many middle-class groups today vis-a-vis crime. That's a rather longer answer than you deserve, but that's my story.
In contrast, and one that's in principle testable, whether it's a continual selfishness in which people never feel sympathy for people who they don't want like themselves.
Mm-hmm.
It's just that they no longer see themselves in the risk pool.
Right.
Or
right.
A breakdown of solidarity in
yep.
which people in a prior period were
yep.
willing to underwrite the welfare of people not like themselves, not because they felt they were sick, but because of a broader sense of community.
Right. Yeah.
And that gets fractured by the get tough on crime story.
Yeah. It isn't so easily testable because the two things don't stand still over time. Because the sense of social separation and segregation and differentiation is actually increasing during this time. Not just demographic shifts in who these other people are, but also where they live, how often one encounters them, the social space and their kind of connectedness and so on. And the neoliberal project exacerbates that, because of course what it does is it means that things like, you know, things as basic and as important as community schools no longer exist. What you find is separation of different schools for different sectors, different races, different groups. And in consequence, there's this sense of, you know, they aren't my neighbour. They aren't citizens just like me. They're this underclass thing that I keep reading about all the time. And my God, you know, something should be done about them, but not with my money. So I think that here, as it were, a perceived self-interest and also a perceived increasing hostility and difference come together, I think. I mean, the whole other aspect of Reagan and Thatcher isn't neoliberal and marketization and laissez-faire. It's the new conservatism and the whole business of return to traditional values and the anathematization of people who do drugs, people who don't marry and have children, people who are on welfare and don't work. That's part of the same story, and that's all about enhancing the hostility and feeding the fear, feeding the difference. You're next.
Yeah, I enjoy very much your talk and it's a very nuanced and detailed explanation of this what you consider global shift in penal policies. And you know, I think on the one hand you describe a very significant shift, you know, for the last 30 years, and also, I agree with that, and I think it's extremely interesting. I have more problem with your interpretative narrative.
Mm-hmm.
It seems to me that although you're quite nuanced, you tend to privilege what I would describe as a pretty mechanistic process of, you know, crime is encouraged by, you know, the growth of wealth and fractured social space. And so, you know, the state is responding, and individuals and communities are responding. And, you know, my own training is to look first at shift in cultural patterns and social ideas that connect the state and citizens or communities, not only between themselves, but also how they envision the very idea of punishment and control, actually, it happens on pressure, which is why is your book entitled Control and what you mean by control. So I was wondering if you thought about that and decided that, no, after all, you know, there is more crime all of a sudden and some responses need to be found.
It's a good point. I would resist the description as a mechanical causation, but I do want to insist on something like that. Let me say what I mean. It does seem to me that the recurring established social fact of a step change in the amount of property crime and violent crime that's experienced in all these different nations through this period, this relatively brief 2-3 decade period, is a fact of life which has consequences for all sorts of different people. Now, that change in, as it were, one's environment, that change in social organization and so on, can be envisaged, can be understood and imagined and acted upon in lots of different ways. One of the ways in which it's done, one of the ways it was done, as it were, rather vigorously and emphatically by criminologists in the 1960s and 70s, was to deny it was happening. Yeah, to say this is not happening. This is a mirage This is a moral panic. This is a kind of a disproportionate response by an overly sensitive, as it were, recording instrument that imagines there's more crime in the world. So that's, you know, that confirms your view. And my claim is that the imagining it away, or as it were, assuming that no need for any rethinking of the problem, because either the problem is an artifact or it's a problem that will soon be dealt with in the light of our older sense of how you control and how you punish and how you deal with crime, that I think was a response that occurred for the best part of two decades. The 1960s and 1970s looked a lot like that. What I'm suggesting is that at a certain point in time, and the criminal justice agencies and criminologists weren't in the lead on this, people began in various settings, various situations, to rethink their relationship and adapt to what was their experience. Now, their experience wasn't just, as it were, on the daily basis, how many people had, you know, victimizations. The experience was overlaid by newspaper reports, by, you know, media, by political representations, and so on. But I think that one did get a sort of a sea change in orientations towards crime at this time. Now, there are very different ways, you know, the possible responses to what I'm describing as a kind of a change in the social surface or the social organization of daily life. There are as many possible changes as, you know, from doing everything to doing nothing to doing a variety of things in between. And I don't say that the responses that one got in the UK and the US are the only ones or were necessitated mechanically by the problem. Problems don't dictate the solutions. They amount to a kind of the most noise in the environment. You know, they can be picked up and perceived or ignored, and they can be interpreted as being this or being that and dealt with differently. What I describe in the book are two very different ways of doing it, and the shift from one to the other. What I hope one sees in other places is an experience that's rather similar, thematized and adapted to very differently. Because it seems to me it's not necessary to, you know, live the characteristic mobility and relative freedom and individualism and the various kind of, you know, economic and cultural freedoms that we now have. We don't have to live them in a kind of fortified, fearful, controlled society. That doesn't seem to me necessary at all. It's the kind of mode that's been adopted, often for political reasons, in response to these experiences and these anxieties and concerns and demands. But I don't think it's the only way. So I think, in principle, disagree with the point that you begin from, which is that one can imagine these things in various ways. But I want to make the claim that this is how they have been imagined and acted on in these places during these times.
It would be interesting to know why. I have to do what I have to do.
This is our
last question.
I was going to say that there's always a kind of dilemma of asking a question just as you have to leave, right? I'd like to ask this question. I'm going to go before I hear you answer. Just to stay very politely. Cesar.
No. Yeah, I want to go back to the issue of neoliberalism and social control, because if you read a kind of similar phenomena by people like Boyd Wakan, it looks like the two elements were part of the same package. You have free markets and you have increased social control. But on the other hand, you have pretty influential people who come from a neoliberal background, say The Economist, for example. The Economist in the UK has been advocating the legalization of drugs for a long time.
Yeah.
Here in the US,
yeah,
you have Milton Friedman advocating a similar policy.
Sure.
And yet, what you have, the mix that you finally get is this moral conservatism coupled with free markets.
Mm-hmm.
So I wonder whether any of the two structural causes that you look into can help us explain this particular mix.
I don't know how I would explain the particular mix. I mean, the contingencies of politics and the appeal of particular value claims and so on at different times. It's the contradiction between neoliberal principles and the crime policies that are currently being developed are really quite stark. I mean, no one would think it was a kind of cost-benefit rational utilization of taxpayers' money to use prisons the way that they're being used today, or to develop many of the forms of punishment that are used. I think that they kind of fly in the face of fiscal accounting, not to mention the fact that they're hugely restrictive of people's liberty. I mean, the liberty interests that are, as it were, underpinning market behavior aren't nothing. You know, it's not as if that's just the kind of fabricated story. Actually, the extent to which people can minimize the state and extend individual freedom of choice is actually a real principle there, linked into the kind of market. The fact that it's belied at every stage by these policies, the notion that you've got a free market and a strong state, and that the strong state's often behaving in ways which are really, you know, counter to anything that the market would allow were it to be the governing force, that's the kind of contradiction that one's describing. How you account for the emergence of a politics that combines these two things is interesting. One story is, look, what you do is you deregulate the economy, you allow it to generate all the risks that it does, and then you police and criminalise the people that can't handle the risks, especially the marginal and the poor. That's a good kind of functional retrospective account. Did anybody plan it that way? I doubt it. Does it look like that's how it's panned out? I think so. To that extent, I always think Luik's account kind of begins from the end and supposes the end was there at the beginning.
Except the get tough part was there from the beginning. I mean, it was right from the beginning of view, let's deal with people in the law and order way. So
sure.
It's not far-fetched to say that, not that the scale of the social control was planned from the beginning, but that the idea that you deal with the disruptions repressively rather than integratively.
Sure, but notice that people are repressing themselves as well. Yeah, one of the.
As much as they're repressing.
No, of course. But let's not forget that. I mean, the reason that I emphasise this aspect that, as it were, how well-to-do, not likely to be imprisoned individuals live their lives under the kind of the sign of crime and crime control and crime avoidance, is interesting in that respect, isn't it? Yeah. Yeah. I mean, what it means, I think, is that crime is not pretextual in this sense. It's not just a pretext to do something else. If it is a pretext to do something else, it's one that's persuading the people who wouldn't be affected by the repression. That's why it seems to me that the story of crime and the collective experience of crime has to be part of the account here, even if people misunderstood their at-risk, likelihood of victimization, even if people misunderstand what crime is about vis-a-vis them. They nevertheless adapt to it in ways that are costly for themselves.
That was NYU Professor of Law and Sociology David Garland speaking earlier last month in Madison, Wisconsin, on the subject of his recent book, The Culture of Control. Thanks to Kevin Walsh for that recording.
Did you ever see a hangman tie a hangknot? Did you ever see a hangman tie a hangknot? I've seen it many a time, and he whines and he whines. After 13 times, he's got a hang knot. Tell me, will that hang knot slip? No, it will not. Will that hang knot slip? No, it will not. Slip around your neck, but it won't slip back again. Hang knot, that hang knot. Did you ever lose a brother on that hang knot? Did you ever lose a brother on that hang knot? My brother was a slave and he tried to escape. They drug him to his grave on a hang knot. Did you ever lose your father on a hang knot? Did you ever lose your father on a hang knot? They hung him from a pole and they shot him full of holes, left him there to rot on that hang knot. Tell me who makes the laws for that hang knot? Who makes the laws for that hang knot? Who says who will go to the calaboose? Get the hangman's noose or the hang knot. I don't know who makes the law for that hang knot. I don't know who makes the law for that hang knot. But the bones of many a man are whistling in the wind just because they tied their laws with a hang knot.
Jeff Schmidt was a staff writer for 19 years at Physics Today. In 2000, Jeff Schmidt published his book, Disciplined Minds, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives. He was then fired from his job. Beginning this week and over the coming weeks, I hope to read most of this book to you, because what Jeff Schmidt has written takes aim at the heart of our social machine. He begins the book by quoting a passage from George Orwell's novel, 1984. It was not easy. It needed a sort of athleticism of mind, an ability at one moment to make the most delicate use of logic, and at the next to be unconscious of the crudest logical errors. Stupidity was as necessary as intelligence and as difficult to attain. I'm going to read you now the introduction to Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt. Schmidt wrote, "This book is stolen, written in part on stolen time, that is. I felt I had no choice but to do it that way. Like millions of others who work for a living, I was giving most of my prime time to my employer. My job simply didn't leave me enough energy for a major project of my own, and no one was about to hire me to pursue my own vision, especially given my irreverent attitude toward employers. I was working in New York City as an editor of a glossy science magazine, but my job, like most professional jobs, was not intellectually challenging and allowed only the most constrained creativity. I knew that if I were not contending with real intellectual challenges and exercising real creativity, and if I were not doing anything to shape the world according to my own ideals, life would be unsatisfying, not to mention stressful and unexciting. The thought of just accepting my situation seemed insane. So I began spending some office time on my own work, dumped my TV to reappropriate some of my time at home, and wrote this book. Not coincidentally, it's about professionals, their role in society, and the hidden battle over personal identity that rages in professional education and employment. The predicament I was in will sound painfully familiar to many professionals. Indeed, generally speaking, professionals today are not happy campers. After years of worshipping work, many seemingly successful professionals are disheartened and burned out, not because of their 70-hour work weeks, but because their salaries are all they have to show for their life-consuming efforts. They long for psychic rewards, but their employer's emphasis on control and the bottom line is giving them only increased workloads, closer scrutiny by management, an unprecedented anxiety about job security. In this way, the cold reality of employer priorities has led to personal crises for many of the country's 21 million professionals. Burned-out professionals may not be immediately obvious to the casual observer, because typically they stay on the job and maintain their usual high level of output, but they feel like they're just going through the motions. They have less genuine curiosity about their work, feel less motivated to do it, and get less pleasure from it. The emotional numbness inevitably spreads from their work lives into their personal lives. According to Herbert J. Freudenberger, the New York psychologist who coined the term burnout in the mid-1970s, the personal consequences are wide-ranging and profound. Cynicism, disconnection, loss of vitality and authenticity, decreased enjoyment of family life, anger, strained relationship with spouse or partner, divorce, obsessive behavior such as workaholism, chronic fatigue, poor eating habits, neglect of friends, social isolation, loneliness, and the list of symptoms goes on. Freudenberger tells me he has seen a big increase in career burnout among professionals in the past 20 years. Ironically, such depression is most likely to hit the most devoted professionals, those who have been the most deeply involved in their work. You can't burn out if you've never been on fire. The problem shows no sign of easing. In fact, the ranks of troubled professionals are swelling as members of Generation X finish school and rack up a few years in the workforce. Many Xers, having observed the unfulfilling work ethic of their baby boom predecessors, want their own working lives to be fun and meaningful from the get-go. Starting out with priorities that took boomers a decade to figure out, but in no better position to act on those priorities, Xers are simply having career crises at an earlier age. Clearly, there is an urgent need to understand why career work so often fails to fulfill its promise. I argue that the hidden root of much career dissatisfaction is the professional's lack of control over the political component of his or her creative work. Explaining this component is a major focus of this book. Today's disillusioned professionals entered their fields expecting to do work that would make a difference in the world and add meaning to their lives. In this book, I show that, in fact, professional education and employment push people to accept a role in which they do not make a significant difference, a politically subordinate role. I describe how the intellectual boot camp known as graduate or professional school, with its cold-blooded expulsions and creeping indoctrination, systematically grinds down the student's spirit and ultimately produces obedient thinkers, highly educated employees who do their assigned work without questioning its goals. I call upon students and professionals to engage in just such questioning, not only for their own happiness, but for the society's sake as well. This book shows that professional education is a battle for the very identity of the individual, as is professional employment. It shows how students and working professionals face intense pressure to compromise their ideals and sideline their commitment to work for a better world. And it explores what individuals can do to resist this pressure, hold on to their values, and pursue their social vision. People usually don't think of school and work in terms of such high-stakes struggle. But if they did, they would be able to explain why so many professional training programs seem more abusive than enlightening, and why so many jobs seem more frustrating than fulfilling. I decided to write this book when I was in graduate school myself, getting a PhD in physics, and was upset to see so many of the best people dropping out or being kicked out. Simply put, those students most concerned about others were the most likely to disappear, whereas their self-centered, narrowly focused peers were set for success. The most friendly, sympathetic, and loyal individuals, those who stubbornly continued to value human contact, were handicapped by the competition. They were at a disadvantage not only because their attention was divided, but also because their beliefs about big-picture issues such as justice and social impact caused them to stop, think, and question. Their hesitation and contemplation slowed them down, tempered their enthusiasm, and drew attention to their deviant priorities, putting them at a disadvantage relative to their unquestioning, gung-ho classmates. Employers, too, I realized, favored people who kept their concerns about the big picture nicely under control, always in a position of secondary importance relative to the assigned work at hand. Thus, I saw education and employment as a self-consistent but deeply flawed system. I wrote this book in the hope of exposing the problem more completely and thereby forcing change. A system that turns potentially independent thinkers into politically subordinate clones is as bad for society as it is for the stunted individuals. It bolsters the power of the corporations and other hierarchical organizations, undermining democracy. As I will explain in detail, it does this by producing people who are useful to hierarchies and only to hierarchies. Uncritical employees ready to be able to extend the reach of their employer's will. At the same time, a system in which individuals do not make a significant difference at their point of deepest involvement in society, that is, at work, undermines efforts to build a culture of real democracy. And in a subordinating system, organizations are more likely to shortchange or even abuse clients because employees who know their place are not effective at challenging employers' policies, even when those policies adversely affect the quality of their own work on behalf of clients. This book is intended for a broad range of professionals, non-professionals, and students, and for anyone interested in how today's society works. It is for students who wonder why graduate or professional school is so abusive. It is for non-professionals who wonder why the professionals at work are so often insufferable and who want to be treated with greater respect. It is for socially concerned professionals who wonder why their liberal colleagues behave so damn conservatively in the workplace. It is for individuals who are frustrated by the restrictions on their work and troubled by the resulting role they play or don't play in the world. It is also for those who simply find their careers much less fulfilling than they had expected and aren't exactly sure why. Disillusioned lawyers, doctors, financial analysts, journalists, teachers, social workers, scientists, engineers, and other highly educated employees are looking for a deeper understanding of why their lives are stressful and feel incomplete. My hope is that readers will find such an understanding in these pages, along with effective strategies for corrective action. If you are a professional coming to understand the political nature of what you do as part of an honest reassessment of what it really means to be a professional could be liberating. It can help you recover your long-forgotten social goals and begin to pursue them immediately, giving your life greater meaning and eliminating a major source of stress. It can help you become a savvy player in the workplace and reclaim some lost autonomy. And ironically, it can help you command greater respect from management and receive greater recognition and reward without necessarily working harder. If you are a student, understanding the political nature of professional work can help you hold on to your values and moral integrity as you navigate the minefields of professional training and later employment. For students trying to get through professional training intact, this book can serve as something of a survival guide, explaining the frightening experiences and warning of what lies in store. If you are a non-professional, you experience even more lack of control, unfulfilling work, insecurity, and other sources of stress than do professionals. As a consequence, the toll on your physical and psychological well-being is even greater than that suffered by professionals. If you want to act individually or collectively to improve your situation, then it pays to know what makes your professional coworkers tick. Such awareness can help you figure out which people you can trust and how far you can trust them. When professional and non-professional employees maintain solidarity in the workplace, they can cover for each other and get more concessions from their employer. But any alliance between unequal partners is doubly risky for the less powerful party, in this case, the non-professionals, who are at the bottom of the workplace hierarchy. By understanding professionals, you reduce the chances of being double-crossed by them. You'll be treated with more respect, too. Whatever your occupation, you have to deal with a variety of professionals when you're off the job. Most of these professionals work for others, not directly for you. Whether you visit an HMO, send kids to school, request a government service, see a counselor, get assistance from a social worker, deal with a lawyer, file a consumer complaint, or contact a local TV station or newspaper, understanding the political nature of professional work will help you to get better service. If you are involved in an independent organization working for social change, you have to contend not only with professionals in the corporations or agencies that your group confronts, but also with professionals advising your own organization. Groups that simply trust professionals without truly understanding them are very likely to be misdirected or sold out by those professionals. And of course, everyone deals with professionals indirectly too. For instance, newspapers, magazines, radio, and television are filled with supposedly objective news reports, analyses, and studies prepared by professionals. What should you believe? To truly understand the output of these or other professionals, you first need to understand the political nature of the professional's role at work. The political nature of professional work is this book's unifying theme. To make the case that the professional's work is inherently political, I examine not only professionals and what they do, but also the system that prepares them to do it, and the battle that one must fight to be politically independent. My hope is that whether you are a professional, a non-professional, or a student, you will find here an unsettling but empowering new way of looking at yourself, your colleagues, the institution that employs or trains you, and society as a whole. This book strives to arm you with a very practical analytical tool that you can use to your advantage in whatever individual and collective struggles you find yourself in as an employee, student, organization member, consumer, or citizen. And that was the introduction to Disciplined Minds by Jeff Schmidt, a critical look at salaried professionals and the soul-battering system that shapes their lives. Over the next coming weeks, I'm going to be reading you from this book. Well, there's no way that we can even hope to get through the first chapter in the remaining time we have on the program this week, but we'll make a start into it. It's titled Timid Professionals. No two people are allowed to read the same thing, I said above the noise, gesturing toward the other passengers on the crowded subway car. My out-of-town visitor glanced around the clattering train. Indeed, the commuters hurtling toward their jobs in Manhattan's office buildings, restaurants, shops, and other workplaces were reading such a wide variety of material that my joke about held up. That typical weekday morning found writers engrossed in all kinds of magazines, paperback books, the Daily News, the Post, the Times, office documents, a software instruction book, and yes, the Bible. Those who weren't reading were listening to headphones, talking to others, or apparently just thinking. Seeing this every day on the subway set me up for a surprise one morning when I went to catch a suburban commuter train to Manhattan. I'd stayed overnight in Westchester County, an upscale New York City suburb where many executives and professionals live. I would be riding into the city with lawyers headed for big corporate law firms, financial analysts going to investment banks, editors bound for publishing conglomerates, as well as accountants, journalists, doctors, architects, engineers, public relations specialists, and a host of other professionals. Boarding the train felt something like entering a library. There were no conversations, even though nearly all of the seats were occupied. Almost everyone was reading, but the dozens of passengers were reading only two things, the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. I could have formulated another joke about allowed reading matter, but the scene was too spooky, like the aftermath of an invasion of the body snatchers. Everyone dressed the same, in suits, sitting silently in neat rows and columns, each holding up a large newspaper, absorbing the same information. A herd of independent minds? Something seemed very wrong with this picture. It was obvious that when the subway riders and the suburban train riders converged at the workplace, the people who showed the greatest diversity in their dress, behavior, and thought, the non-professionals, would be asked to do the least creative work, while the most regimented people would be assigned the creative tasks. This seemed just the opposite of what one might expect, and even more disturbingly, it indicated that people who do creative work are not necessarily independent thinkers. Evidence that professionals are not independent thinkers has been around for a long time, but has generally been ignored, in part because people don't know how to make sense of it. The Vietnam War produced some revealing examples which are worth looking back at. On January 12, 1971, the federal government indicted Philip Berrigan and other East Coast anti-war activists on felony charges of plotting to impede the Vietnam War through violent action. The activists' agenda supposedly included blowing up underground heating pipes in Washington to shut down government buildings, kidnapping presidential advisor Henry Kissinger to ransom him for concessions on the war, and raiding draft boards to destroy records and slow down the draft. The Justice Department prosecutors chose to hold the conspiracy trial in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, a conservative area where a randomly chosen jury would be heavily against the defendants. However, before the jury was selected at what came to be known as the Harrisburg 7 trial, a group of left-leaning social scientists supporting the defendants interviewed a large number of registered voters in the area to try to figure out how to get a sympathetic jury there. They discovered, among other things, that college-educated people were more likely than others to be conservative and to trust the government. Thus, in court, during the 3 weeks that it took to examine 465 potential jurors and pick a panel of 12, lawyers for the defense quietly favored skilled blue-collar workers and white-collar workers without a lot of formal education, non-professionals, although the sociologists and lawyers apparently never used that term. The lawyers were uneasy doing this, however, because it went against their intuition. The notion of close-minded hard hats and open-minded intellectuals is widespread and is reinforced by mass media characters like loading dock worker Archie Bunker and his college student son-in-law, Pinko Mike. In fact, All in the Family made its television debut the very day of the Harrisburg indictments, 12th of January, 1971. By the time the trial and jury selection started, it had been on the air for a year. Ignoring these false stereotypes paid off. The government put on a month-long $2 million extravaganza featuring 64 witnesses, including 21 FBI agents and 9 police officers. The defense called no one to the witness stand. After 7 days of deliberation, the jury was not able to reach a unanimous decision, and the judge declared a mistrial. But with 10 of the 12 carefully selected jurors arguing for a not guilty verdict, the government dropped the case. Blue-collar skeptics? Loyal intellectuals? Was the Harrisburg survey a regional fluke? Look at what the nationwide polls showed at the time. On February 15, 1970, the New York Times reported the results of a Gallup poll on the war in Vietnam. Gallup had found that the number of people in sharp disagreement with the government over the war had increased but still constituted a minority. While this increase in opposition was important news, what was particularly intriguing were the data on the opinions of subgroups of the population. The numbers announced with striking clarity that those with the most schooling were the most reluctant to criticize the government's stand in Vietnam. There was a simple correlation, although only in part a cause and effect relationship. The further people had gone before leaving school, the less likely they were to break with the government over the war. During the war in Vietnam, nearly everyone seemed to have one or another gripe about the U.S. government's efforts, but few took positions that dissented fundamentally from the government's goals. Some said they were for negotiation, some said they were for an end to the bombing, and some simply said they were for peace. Gallup's survey cut to the bottom line by posing what was always the most incisive question on the war. It asked people whether they would favor or oppose the immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops from Vietnam. Age didn't affect the answers much. The ratio of those in favor to those opposed was about the same for young adults as it was for older people, but dramatic differences appeared according to formal education. Those with college educations opposed immediate withdrawal by more than 2-1, whereas those not formally schooled beyond the elementary grades were evenly divided on the question, and high school graduates were in between. Polls taken earlier and later in the Vietnam War, and polls taken during other wars, Korea for example, show the same correlation with formal education. Gallup was not the only one to find this connection between attitude and formal education. In a study entitled, A Degree and What Else? Correlates and Consequences of a College Education, sponsored by the Carnegie Commission on Higher Education, researchers found college graduates to be more supportive or hawkish than the rest of the population. Even in 1968, a year of rising anti-war sentiment and militant actions against the war, people who had been to college remained less likely than others to criticize the U.S. intervention in Vietnam, the Carnegie study found. People's reluctance to criticize the war was not simply the result of their careful analysis of an isolated issue. Rather, the position people took on the war followed almost mechanically from their overall political outlook, although some had their overall political outlook radicalized by what they experienced when they acted to do something about the war. With Americans being killed every day, almost everything one said about the U.S. intervention in Vietnam was heard as a statement on the U.S. political, economic, and social system itself, and rightly so. Thus, a narrow statement against the war could elicit a broad response such as, "If you don't like it here, go to Russia." Few now seem to remember that throughout most of the war, those who called for immediate withdrawal of all U.S. troops were seen as radicals, as critics of a lot more than the war. This explains in part the disparity between opposition and activism, why many opponents of the war didn't speak out publicly. More students than workers were anti-war activists, even though workers who had anti-war sentiments far outnumbered students of all persuasions. Workers organizing publicly to get the United States out of Vietnam risked a lot more, namely their jobs, because their employers were likely to see them as radicals and therefore a threat to the tranquility of the local workforce. And I'm reading from Disciplined Minds, A Critical Look at Salaried Professionals and the Soul-Battering System That Shapes Their Lives by Jeff Schmidt. And I'm going to have to stop here partway through Chapter 1 and will continue next week. For your information, Disciplined Minds is published by Bowman and Littlefield. And guess what? Surprise, surprise, Oxford, England. Thank you for listening to another edition of Unwelcome Guests. Our theme music, Unwelcome Guest, is performed by Billy Bragg and Wilco, with lyrics by Woody Guthrie. If you'd like to contact us, we have a website, unwelcomeguests.org, and you can also download archived copies in MP3 of previous shows. If you'd like to send some of your professional friends to see this material.